Todd Feinberg, now 2 till 6 on WTIC News Talk 1080.
Facebook is the big story. Well, there are a lot of big stories, yeah, but Facebook is ridiculous how big it is and how distorted it is and how none of the answers, the few that there are, seem acceptable and at least not full. So we're having conversations trying to clarify that. And joining us now is William Reinhart. He's with the Center for Growth and Opportunity. That's at Utah State University. Do you go by anything shorter or do you just do William?
Just go by Will. Yeah.
Will is good.
Yeah, of course.
Good. Thank you for taking the time to be here.
Yeah, of course.
So this Facebook thing, even the basic facts, We don't know what happened. How did Facebook go down? But Facebook says they were just diddling with their technology and they shut it off for a few hours. No big deal. Is that a viable explanation?
So earlier this week, the downtime that Facebook seems to have had, at least in part, is driven by like a really interesting, weird kind of technical space. So basically, what they were trying to do is update the address book of the internet, and they kind of incorrectly updated the address book. And when they did that, they were not able to get back into their own system to update that address book. And so it kind of locked everyone out. And so they had to do like a really hard reset on everything. And that took apparently about 2.5 to 3 hours. That really should never have happened. But it's kind of this weird technical part of the internet that makes everything kind of work.
Well, I've had to change my DNSs before. And so I understand that there is this coding in the background that guides us around. It's hard to believe that Facebook would do something so stupid. Those are the kinds of mistakes that tend to ruin the world, I guess.
Yes. It does seem odd that they put everything through Facebook.com, that all of their services went through Facebook.com. It kind of makes sense because a lot of other companies do it this way. But the fact that they didn't have a backup and they really didn't have a plan if something like this did happen, that does seem to me a little odd.
So the other explanation I heard secondary to that was that it was all in a locked room their own server space, and they needed to physically get to the servers and they couldn't open the doors because it was based on an IP protocol or something to be able to access. Does that explanation make any sense?
Yeah. So because everything is connected to each other, because the entire system is connected to each other, that when the Facebook.com went down, when it went down, all of the subsystems that were connected to Facebook.com, including the ability to even swipe into the building, went down. So they had to actually, from my understanding, they had to get a hard wire cutter to cut into the server first they had to get into the building. Yeah. And then get into the server. And in order to basically reset everything and reset their own, their version of the Facebook address on the internet's phone book. So that to me seems to be a big problem that they didn't. I'm sure they'll probably have solutions for this in the future, that they probably won't make this mistake in the future. But
yeah, but
it seems odd that.
So this is what doesn't make sense to me, having been a business owner and knowing what it's like, is I would never, and I don't think anybody would, it's beyond me, but maybe the internet has just made people dumber about practical things. Like, you don't design an electronic passkey system without an override for, say, if there's no electricity, even if you have a battery backup for when there's no electricity. And you wouldn't have an IP-based security system, because security systems are based on insecurity. They're based on the violation of your daily norms. You don't have a system to protect you from your own system that depends on the system. It just doesn't make any sense. And maybe the world's just gotten so tech drooly that they pay no attention to common sense.
What I think is really interesting about this, to kind of put this into context, is that Facebook has generally been known as being one of the most technically savvy social media companies, at least traditionally. This was the thing that really propelled Facebook in its early days above and beyond MySpace. I remember MySpace very well, having been one of the early users on MySpace. And what was interesting about MySpace is that it constantly had technical errors. It was a very glitchy, buggy system. And what Facebook really did was change the pattern on social media such that, you know, those technical glitchy errors didn't exist. Their first hire was actually an engineer. So the first person they hired was an engineer to do better technical back-end work for Facebook. So the fact that all this has happened, especially given what else has been going on with Congress and all these other issues that the company is dealing with, to me, it just seems to show that there does need to be probably, not necessarily, I wouldn't say change, but it's clearly that Facebook needs to be doing a better job on a whole bunch of different fronts.
Well, they should hire me to consult, at least. I would tell them not to do such dumb things. All right, let's switch over to the Congress part of it then.
Yeah.
What my read on Congress is that this is unbelievable, that the United States of America government, its most elite side of the legislature, is sitting around actively plotting to destroy one of America's most successful entrepreneurs in history and also one of its biggest tech companies, and that they are seeking to kidnap the power that Facebook has to, one, as an electioneering tool. It's probably the most powerful tool in politics today. Mm-hmm. And two, because it's the new press, essentially. And they're looking to kidnap. This is like they're trying to take over the New York Times, in my mind.
I think there is a lot to that. I think that is actually they clearly see, Congress clearly sees, and especially the Senate clearly sees, Facebook as having a lot of political power. And they're trying to at least, I don't know if they want to curtail it, but they're trying to contain it and to try to channel it in a very, very interesting sort of way. You know, we can get more into this, but the back and forth between Congress and Facebook, to me, has been the most interesting sort of story that hasn't been told during this entire kerfuffle over the last 2 weeks. That in
you,
fact,
you mean there's a larger narrative here that.
Yeah. So in 2018, both the Senate and the House brought Mark Zuckerberg in front of Congress to basically, you know, to respond to claims that his company had really shifted the election in 2016 with Cambridge Analytica. The company then made changes that now the new whistleblower is saying that those changes that the company made in 2018, which he clearly said that these are the changes that Mark Zuckerberg made in order to appease Congress back then, are having detrimental effects now. And so you see this threat that Congress placed in, you know, or this, you know, the sword of Damocles that Congress placed over Facebook. They changed, they shifted some of their practices. And now in shifting that practice, they then are coming back to the table and are now being criticized, probably rightly in some regards, but being criticized again for not doing the right thing.
So this is their response to an attempt by Congress to regulate them in some way.
Yeah.
That Congress is now saying that they didn't do the regulation the way Congress would have wanted. So this is a failure of Congress to not do oversight of and have more conversations, perhaps?
I think that it's that, and also that whenever Congress brings or hauls a company into committee, the companies take this very, very seriously. And whether or not there actually is regulatory changes that are made, the companies are going to shift. They feel that there is this threat that is looming. And that's what Facebook did. They felt like there was clear threats that were looming. They shifted some of their practices. And it's those practices and that shift of those practices, in part, that this new whistleblower had brought to attention to Congress again. And yet, to me, that part of the conversation, that pre-2018 conversation, how Facebook itself shifted in response to congressional oversight, that was not part of the Senate conversations over the last two hearings. It's like partly the reason why Facebook is doing the things they're doing is because Congress had pushed them kind of subtly to do those things when they brought Zuckerberg in to account for Cambridge Analytica. And now they're being called in to account for those things that they changed as well.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it's kind of it's a really difficult problem to figure out how to serve 2 billion some users the content that they want. And in part, I think that obviously Facebook probably needs, I mean, Facebook does have oversight to an extent with their own oversight board, but the impositions that Congress has and the fact that they keep on bringing the company into committee to, you know, account for all of these concerns, that subtly shifts the company to choose different sorts of things and different sorts of actions. And so it's kind of a, you know, almost like a whack-a-mole sort of.
Yeah, there's an organic movement going on over time. Yeah. And Congress is part of that conversation. We're talking to Will Reinhart. He's from the Center for Growth and Opportunity. So really then, well, the part that worries me about this is, as I listened to the testimony, there was a lot of criticism of social media for being social media in a sense. I mean, you know, I look forward to what the algorithm does. If you know, we can all argue over how Twitter or Facebook or whatever might be different if you weren't being guided to those things that you're guided to. But I can't see it as some kind of antitrust or criminal activity or negligence to feed people back their own family's responses to things they post, as opposed to news stories about in regard to what they post. Those arguments make no sense to me.
I'm very much with you. And I do think that there are benefits to those sorts of filters, right? I've connected, I don't have a huge Twitter following, but I'm able to connect with people across the world on topics that I care about, on you know, on research and on policy issues. You know, I'm a policy nerd and econ nerd, and I'm able to connect and talk with people in a way that I don't think I would have ever been able to in the past, and get new information. That's clearly a benefit to the kind of filter and the algorithms that clearly do exist.
Yeah, so they were presenting all this as negatives and downside.
Yeah,
and sort of evil package they were putting it into. But there are goods they were ignoring.
And in fact, the reports that came from the Wall Street Journal said that they said that, you know, when you look at Instagram writ large, about one out of every five people say that it makes some things worse. But, you know, the other four out of five people think that either it makes things better or it just doesn't really change things all that much. And that was, again, when you even look at the material that was released by the Wall Street Journal, there was a lot of emphasis on the negative aspects of Instagram. And in particular, it really seems the biggest concern seems to be around body image of teens, and specifically teen girls. So that's something I think that probably and I know the platform has been trying to deal with. That I think probably should be the focus, is focus on very, very clear problems that even the platform knows probably does exist. But writ large, there's still a lot of positives, and people who go on these websites and use these platforms think that it is actually a very positive thing for them overall.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll continue with Will Reinhart. Stay with us on WTIC.
Miss something from the Todd Feinberg Show? Listen to the podcast on WTIC.com/podcast.
WTIC, we're continuing with Will Reinhart from the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. And I love having somebody finally. We've been having our own conversations about Facebook, but Will, it's nice to have somebody who studies this full time to bounce it around with. If you were describing to somebody what took place this week, how would you package it for them so they could understand the context?
I think what we saw this week, especially with the whistleblower, was it was an interesting sort of event that kind of was a summary of, I think, a lot of the tensions that are going on with Facebook. Fundamentally, there are obviously positives to Facebook, and there are also negatives to Facebook. And I think that when you actually looked at the conversation that the whistleblower had, a lot of that really did exist. She was very, very clear that she didn't want to break up Facebook. She thought that reforms could happen that could make the company better. She also was very clear that certain kinds of actions that could have been taken could make everyone's lives better and make the companies more profitable. So to me, there's what's interesting about this is that the whistleblower actually, I thought, had a pretty nuanced position, being a part of the internals of the company, you know, being actually part of the company at a very high level, and also being kind of internal to all of these processes. So to me, it really was an interesting insight into Facebook. But at the same time, I think that what she emphasized were the things that I'm trying to emphasize here as well, which is, you know, that there are good parts to Facebook there and Instagram, and there are bad parts to Facebook and Instagram, and that we need to give teens and adults the tools to deal with both sides of these things we need to maximize the good, but also minimize the bad.
Senator Blumenthal, who is, you know, we were focused on in Connecticut because he's our senator.
Oh, yeah.
Made a big deal out of comparing Facebook to tobacco companies.
Yes.
And tobacco companies killed people. Their company secrets that were under attack were deadly secrets.
Yes.
These secrets are business secrets that you may not like because they may damage people's body image if children are being allowed to use a platform that they're not emotionally ready for. Mm-hmm. But I don't see that connectivity between those, that analogy of a Facebook to tobacco. And that kind of attack, I just think, is inappropriate.
I thought that was a really, really bad analogy, in fact, because we knew that tobacco companies, by, I believe it was the 60s or at least early 70s, they had very, very good understanding that tobacco, you know, they caused open sores, they caused cancers, they caused tumors. It was very, very clear from their own research by the late 60s and early 70s that these things occurred, that big, you know, these tobacco, the actual, you know, tobacco use was very, very, very detrimental and it killed people. Now, what we're seeing with Facebook and social media companies is something that's not even close to that. People aren't getting killed by social media. What we're seeing are very, you know, unbalanced effects. You know, there are some things that are bad, there are some things that are good. And that to me seems to be a much different sort of problem. But more, but even, you know, taking that just one step further, the kinds of regulatory things that happened with big tobacco, of, you know, of trying to regulate them, trying to regulate their advertising, trying to regulate all these other things that were related to these companies, the big tobacco companies. I don't think that that really applies here for social media giants.
What it does apply? If you were doing the characterization of Facebook and other social media companies, what would you say the dangers and benefits are?
So I think the clear danger that exists with some of these companies is that you end up spending too much time on them and not enough time developing your own self. I think this is the big, big problem for teens and adolescents, that they use social media as a way to escape and not as a time to read and to, you know, to develop and to play in the way that they should. So those things, I think, are very clear for adolescents. I think the similar sort of thing kind of exists for adults as well, that, you know, I find myself doing this, that I spend way too much time trying to, you know, sometimes too much time online and not enough time with friends hanging out. And, you know, obviously it's been kind of difficult in the last couple of years, but, you know,
that's been a good time to have social media to distract.
It is a good time, which we've seen that a lot of people, even who are critical of social media, change with COVID as well. So I think there are some things that we should be thinking about more critically, which is, what are the kinds of ethics that we should be having? Should we be taking social media sabbaticals, which I think is the case? I do this every once in a while. Most weekends I'm not online. We're still at this kind of early stage of what technology looks like and how we're adapting to technology.
I think that's a really good point.
And I see it as digital adolescence. We're still at an early digital adolescence for everyone. We're parents are still figuring out how to develop this and how to teach their kids. That was also clearly came out through the hearings that parents don't really know how to deal with these technologies. So we need more tools. We need better understanding. We need to understand also that sometimes some people shouldn't be on social media, right? Some teens shouldn't be on social media. Some parents shouldn't be on social media. My mom, I love her to death, but she's not on social media because she doesn't like the kinds of political conversations that her friends were engaged in. So she left social media writ large. And I think that's the kind of things that we should encourage. We should encourage people to figure out what technology should look like in their own homes. But more fundamentally, the technology itself really is, it can be beneficial if it's used correctly, but we need to start having a better conversation about what correct use and beneficial use for individuals actually looks like.
Will Reinhart, the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University, thank you for taking the time to talk with us. It's been helpful.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
New this week on Curiosity Stream. Witness the meteoric rise of YouTuber Jimmy Donaldson, aka Mr. Beast, made famous by his jaw-dropping charity.
We'd like to give you